This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Unfortunately, sexual assaults on college campuses are not unusual. This year, a new law took effect, hoping to make students safer.
And until we get to the point where our statistics are zero, we all have more work to do. Our society as a whole needs to take it as a serious issue.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear if the Campus Save Act is making a difference in a state with a high assault rate. We'll also travel to Portugal and hear how art is helping students build self-esteem. Find out how teachers can avoid cyber traps waiting for them online, and spend an academic minute figuring out just how Mexican your favorite Mexican restaurant really is. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, also known as the Campus Save Act, has gone into effect this school year nationwide. The law lays out new protocols colleges and universities must follow when it comes to preventing, reporting, and responding to sexual assault. Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania spearheaded the legislation. The state of Wyoming, however, with its one university, ranks fourth in the country in sexual assault reports per student. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrenk spoke with administrators and advocates at the University of Wyoming about how sexual assaults are handled there and has this report.
Someone was sexually assaulted on UW's campus on the very first day of classes this year. It wasn't an isolated incident. Between 2011 and 2013, 27 sexual assaults were reported to campus authorities. And UW Police Chief Mike Samp says the problem is much worse than we know.
According to FBI statistics, only about 1 in 10 victims of sexual assault ever report to law enforcement. So although that number may seem high, we could actually have much higher numbers of victims out there.
In Samp's nearly two decades policing UW, he's found some common characteristics to these crimes on campus, like alcohol.
Virtually every sexual assault that we have reported to us at the police department, there was alcohol involved by the suspect, the victim, or both. We don't have a high incidence of stranger sexual assault. They virtually all occur by people that are known to the victim.
A Department of Justice study found that as many as 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted during their time in college, usually by someone in their social circle. A few years back, about 7% of UW students surveyed said they'd experienced a sexual assault. Samp says it's the most common violent crime on campus.
It does happen here. They are real incidents. And until we get to the point where our statistics are zero, we all have more work to do. Our society as a whole needs to take it as a serious issue.
The new federal rules call for more education on college campuses, increased reporting requirements, and clearer policies for how sexual misconduct is handled. Megan Selheim runs the university's Stop Violence program. She says before UW overhauled its policy to meet the mandate, victims did not know what would happen to them when they reported a sexual assault to administrators.
It's now much more consistent and clear. And so it makes it a lot easier for me to be able to tell a student very plainly, first this will happen, here's what you can expect.
Some victims seek criminal charges against their attackers. Some opt for sanctions through the university's student conduct process. Selheim explains that process can include an investigation, a conduct hearing, and an appeal. Investigators and hearing officers use a preponderance of evidence as the burden of proof in these cases.
They make a determination as to whether or not what has been alleged is more likely than not to have happened.
That's a lesser burden than the beyond a reasonable doubt used in criminal courts. In the last academic year, 3 students were expelled from UW for violating its sexual misconduct policy. Selheim says the process is more prompt and private than a trial.
Most of the students I work with appreciate having a reporting option that sort of splits the difference between the criminal process and nothing at all.
But either option can be extremely difficult for trauma victims. Becca Fisher works with sexual violence survivors as director of Albany County Safe Project.
Most of the people that I have served who have engaged any of those processes have had a level of frustration.
In UW's process, Fisher says the punishment doesn't always fit the crime, like a student being expelled, but only after he graduated, and another expelled student whose transcript cited personal reasons instead of his sexually violent behavior.
those kinds of things are troubling to me as an advocate, because that means that while they're being somewhat held accountable, they're likely off to the next place to potentially repeat the same thing.
Fisher says it's less than ideal when the people handling sexual misconduct investigations and hearings report directly to administrators who have an interest in making sure that the university is perceived a certain way.
It does become tricky, and I don't think that the University of Wyoming is necessarily immune to some of those political pressures.
We're really focused on the ongoing education that we provide students.
UW Dean of Students Sean Blackburn says his priority is educating students, as the new rules require, to stop assaults before they happen. Those efforts include an online portal, panels during orientation, and campus-wide awareness events. Blackburn also hopes that leads to more sexual assault reporting.
As we expand our awareness programs, we expect to see those numbers to slowly climb as we address the true issue that was always there.
And UW is also required to share those numbers with the public. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
A 25-year-old woman named Margarita is helping children of color living in the outskirts of Lisbon, Portugal, rebuild their confidence and take pride in their heritage through art. Damaia, Portugal is plagued by crime and poverty and has a bad reputation. Families who live there are often looked down upon. Margarita has set out to help marginalized children in the neighborhood rebuild their self-esteem and bring better understanding to their heritage. DW Radio correspondent Nadia Danish reports.
In a big blue room, three kids are sitting in a circle sharing stories about their week. Nine-year-old Lidiane goes first and tells the rest of the group how her mother cried when she gave her a gift Lidiane had created at school. I asked her if she's crying because she's happy or sad, and she said, it's because she's happy. The kids who are here today are participating in a special educational program in a social center in Damaia, a majority black neighborhood on the outskirts of Lisbon, plagued by crime and poverty. Many of the families living there are marginalized.
These children we work with, they come from poverty contexts, from families that live apart, very complex familiar structures. This is a risky context. There's lots of risks in these neighborhoods regarding drug dealing and other things like that.
That's Margarida, a 25-year-old Portuguese who originally studied management in Lisbon. But then she realized she wanted to do something different, and so she went to the UK, where she studied art as a therapy. 2 years ago, she came back to her home country of Portugal to launch her own educational project called DART. The project is based on using art to help marginalized children, like the ones present today, develop self-esteem and to help them deal with difficult situations.
When we were going to school, there were a lot of policemen around, and I started to cry. They thought that the children had drugs in their bags, and then they inspected my bag.
Margarida is trying to counter negative experiences like the one Lidiane just described by teaching the kids something positive. She believes that everyone can build a piece of art by themselves and be successful at it.
It's a place where they can create things, where they can, through art, travel to other dimensions and to imagine, to use creativity, to find solutions. And hopefully this way they will build some skills that they can use in their lives outside.
Margarida just finished telling the kids a story about a penguin who decided he wants to fly. Now she picks up a CD from a shelf and puts it in a CD player. It's Mozart's Piano Sonata No. 11.
We always listen to classic music because it calms us down.
Now it's time for some art. The kids are getting ready to paint birds they made out of used shampoo bottles and put on old white t-shirts to protect their clothes from the color. Lilian is already busy painting her bird. The body is pink, wings are blue, and lips are red.
Mine will be awesome. I'm feeling proud of my work.
Margarida hopes by teaching the kids arts and craft, she will trigger skills they can use in the future.
Hopefully, this has an impact in their daily lives. So usually we see a difference of their behavior in class, either because they are managing a bit better and finding that they can concentrate a bit more, or because they were too shy and then suddenly they want to answer a question or to go to the board and write a sentence.
Wolfgang Lind is a German psychologist based in Lisbon and has been following DART's work from the beginning. He says DART has already made a difference.
They get a lot of positive feedback and they are not sometimes used to it. And they feel proud of something they did. And it has also an impact in learning process in school.
And that's not all. According to Lind, DART also helps these marginalized kids to be proud of their heritage.
They invite African artists, famous more or less, and so it's very important for these young people to see that you can, on a long term, be something, even if you are colored, to get proud also of their African roots.
Currently, DART is offered in 2 schools and in 3 social institutions across Lisbon. It's a non-profit charity financed mostly by donors but also by training sessions in private companies and private schools. Since its launch 2 years ago, DART has reached more than 200 children aged 5 to 16. But Margarida has even bigger dreams.
I would like to be spread around more schools in Lisbon and in 10 years all around Portugal.
For DW, this is Nadia Diniz in Lisbon.
Still to come, the internet has changed the way many teachers do their job over the past 20 years, but that old information superhighway has quite a few speed traps that can ensnare even the best educator. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. There's no doubt that the internet has become a valuable tool for students and teachers alike. But like most everything, there is a downside to this constant flow of information and connectedness. These are traps that teachers can find themselves falling into with no easy way out. Frederick Lane is trying to help. In his book, Cyber Traps for Educators, he goes into the various ways that teachers can get into a little bit of cyber trouble on and off the job. We spoke earlier this year, and I asked him if the internet is just the devil.
No, actually, I would disagree with that. And look, I've done cyber traps for the young. I lecture to parent groups. A good part of my job, frankly, is a little bit of consciousness raising, shall we say, as opposed to frightening. But the thing that I talk about a lot, Bob, is that it's not the technology, it's the behavior. And the problem is with technology is that it makes certain behaviors easier to indulge in.
Many of the traps you talk about in your book would be traps for anyone in any career, but teachers, they have a little more scrutiny put on them, don't they?
They really do, and that actually is nothing new. When you look at the historical materials that I referenced, really for the better part of a century, parents and communities have held teachers to a higher standard. And that makes a certain amount of sense. Look, I'm the father of 4 boys myself. I completely get this. We're asking these individuals to spend 8 to 10 hours a day with our children and to serve as role models. And so there's an expectation that they will maintain a certain standard of behavior.
Very interesting, the standard of behavior in the 1905 teaching contract that you posted there. That's a tough gig.
It is a tough gig, and I think it has a bunch of interesting pieces to it. I really encourage people to take a look at it because, for starters, it really indicates just how much surveillance there was of a teacher's life. The other piece of it, too, of course, is the role that women played. And I think that certainly there was a very paternalistic attitude that school boards felt that they could dictate much more heavily the terms of a female teacher's life. That being said, I think that part of what teachers need to be aware of is that today, a lot of the wounds that they suffer in terms of privacy are self-inflicted. Even back in 1905, when teachers went to their home or their apartment or whatever and shut the door and drew the curtains, they had a private life. And, basically as long as nothing outrageous was occurring that would attract public attention, they could, behave as they wished. Unfortunately today, particularly younger teachers have a tendency to try to document their life and to put stuff out on Facebook and Twitter and so forth. And so they're not really living private lives anymore.
And people who have shared even what by any standard would be the most innocent of things, holding a glass of wine at a party, have come under scrutiny and some have actually lost jobs for it. That's amazing.
It really is amazing to me. And I think it underscores the challenging aspect for teachers that what's acceptable in one community is not necessarily acceptable in all communities. And I think one of the things that we're seeing happen is that the internet is creating this perception of uniform acceptability of certain behaviors. And teachers lose sight of the fact sometimes that they still have to deal with the attitudes of the people in the community where they're teaching.
There have also been traps that teachers can fall in that are being set by students. Students setting up phony Twitter accounts and tweeting stuff that teachers shouldn't be tweeting. Is this something that they're really going to have to be on the lookout for?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I talk about both for educators and for kids is that we all need to be aware of the fact now that we have a brand identity online. The fact that you can go out and Google someone's name means that the public perception of them is, to a large extent, determined by what shows up in the Google search. So I really do stress for educators that periodically they need to do a Google search of their name. They need to search Facebook. They need to search Twitter, Instagram, all of these different apps now to get a sense of what information is associated with them. And, the sooner that they find out that there's something disreputable or potentially embarrassing, the sooner that they can actually address the problem and try to get that information taken down, or alternatively go to their supervisor and say, I want you to know I found this and this is a problem and this is not me.
It's interesting because so much is talked about with cyberbullying of students. This is actually a form of cyberbullying of teachers.
Yeah, and that's a growing trend. One of the things that I've been looking at is some new research, particularly from the United Kingdom, that makes it absolutely clear that teachers are very often the victims of cyberbullying. And I think what's really disturbing about this, Bob, is that it's not just kids who are doing this. A significant percentage of the cyberbullying that teachers experience actually stems from parents. But I think we have a cultural issue that we're still working through in terms of how easy it is for people to bully others online.
And not to put teachers up on the pedestal, because there are times when some of these problems are of their own making. Cyber loafing, which is a problem in almost every profession, is certainly a problem in the classroom.
Of course, right. And, I did a book a few years ago, Bob, called The Naked Employee, which was about workplace privacy issues. When I was doing it back in 2003, we were just starting to see a lot of the computerized surveillance of employees and trying to monitor their activities. And cyber loafing was a huge piece of that because the internet was really taking off and, people were spending endless hours playing solitaire and things like that. So we're absolutely not singling out teachers to say that cyber loafing is a potential problem. And in fact, I think it's fair to say that given the nature of teaching, it's a little bit harder for teachers to spend hours visiting ESPN or shopping on eBay or something like that because, you know, they've got students that they have to deal with.
Well, the genie is out of the bottle. This is not going away. So at the end of the book, you do come up with precautions and solutions. And the number one is that number one word, think. You probably give no better advice than that.
Well, and it's hard because, you know, all of us use electronics, right? And we're familiar with the distractive capabilities of the internet. And it is challenging. We all should think. But teachers especially, who really face that level of increased scrutiny, need to step back periodically and say, I'm in a slightly different position than somebody who's working in an office somewhere without kids or anything like that. My community expects me to behave in a certain way, and that's really the decision I've made, to accept that as part of the job. So, yes, teachers do need to think. I mean, it's really a play on the old IBM slogan, you know, which Thomas Watson Sr. plastered all over the company. And to the extent that, you know, you're engaged in some kind of online conversation or your gut is making you wonder whether or not you should do something, well, first of all, you probably shouldn't because you should trust your instincts. But, you know, particularly teachers should make a habit of consulting with colleagues, talking with supervisors to really give themselves an opportunity to avoid the most obvious trouble that they might be getting into.
Frederick Lane is an author, attorney, and professional speaker on the legal and cultural implications of emerging technologies. His book is called Cyber Traps for Educators. So before you feast on that arroz con pollo or chalupa, just how Mexican is that Mexican food? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is your favorite Mexican restaurant authentic? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Stephen Crist, temporary assistant professor of sociology at Truman State University, explains how he went behind the scenes to study authenticity.
In our contemporary globalized society, goods and services are exchanged at rates like never before. Food, as one of the most visible forms of globalization, represents a direct expression of group identity and individual subjectivity. The relationship linking explicitly ethnic foods and an American consumer base which desires a real or genuine ethnic experience at a restaurant is complicated by the nature of the restaurant business. As businesses, restaurants must manage their unique displays of taste and style within the bounds of a local environment's order of supply and demand. A major concern is the presentation and reception of authentic ethnic food. In order to investigate the concept of authenticity, over the course of 2.5 years, I volunteered to work at more than a dozen Mexican restaurants. Staff were initially suspicious of me and assigned me menial tasks like shoveling snow from parking lots. Eventually, I overcame barriers and gained insider access to the community. What I found was, authenticity is socially organized. In order for a restaurant to produce a profit, it must cater to clientele who oftentimes have little experience with or knowledge of traditional meals and methods of preparation. As a matter of principle, the level of authenticity achievable in a restaurant always must reflect the palates of consumers. This negotiation process is very real, as many restaurants employ taste tests with customers to secure approval of a dish before adding it to the menu. My research is also contributing to the larger conversation on immigrant integration in the U.S. When we examine the history of ethnic foods such as pizza and hamburgers, we see that these foods have been integrated into mainstream American culture. The same thing is happening with Mexican food. For instance, salsa has now replaced ketchup as the number one condiment in the United States, and this could hold key insights into the future integration of Mexican immigrants and how they're shaping the culture in which they're settling.
That was Stephen Crist of Truman State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.